Scaramouche, Book 2, Chapter 1. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, please visit LibriVox.org. This reading by Gordon Mackenzie. Scaramouche, A Romance of the French Revolution, by Raphael Sabatini. Book 2, Chapter 1. The Trespassers. Coming presently upon the Redden Road, André Louis, obeying instinct rather than reason, turned his face to the south and plodded wearily and mechanically forward. He had no clear idea of whither he was going, or of whither he should go. All that imported at that moment was to put as great a distance as possible between Gavrillac and himself. He had a vague, half-formed notion of returning to Nantes, and there, by employing the newly found weapon of his oratory, excite the people into sheltering him as the first victim of the persecution he had foreseen, and against which he had sworn them to take up arms. But the idea was one which he entertained merely as an indefinite possibility, upon which he felt no real impulse to act. Meanwhile, he chuckled at the thought of Fresnel, as he had last seen him, with his muffled face and glaring eyeballs. "For one who was anything but a man of action," he writes, "I felt that I had acquitted myself none so badly." It is a phrase that recurs at intervals in his sketchy Confessions. Constantly is he reminding you that he is a man of mental and not physical activities, and apologizing when dire necessity drives him into acts of violence. I suspect this insistence upon his philosophic detachment, for which I confess he had justification enough, to betray his besetting vanity. With increasing fatigue came depression and self-criticism. He had stupidly overshot his mark in insultingly denouncing M. de Lesdiguières. "It is much better," he says somewhere, "to be wicked than to be stupid. Most of this world's misery is the fruit, not, as priests tell us, of wickedness, but of stupidity." And we know that of all stupidities he considered anger the most deplorable. Yet he had permitted himself to be angry with a creature like M. de Lesdiguières, a lackey, a fribble, a nothing, despite his potentialities for evil. He could perfectly have discharged his self-imposed mission without arousing the vindictive resentment of the king's lieutenant. He beheld himself vaguely launched upon life with the riding suit in which he stood, a single louis d'or and a few pieces of silver for all capital, and a knowledge of law which had been inadequate to preserve him from the consequences of infringing it. He had, in addition, but these things that were to be the real salvation of him he did not reckon, his gift of laughter, sadly repressed of late, and the philosophic outlook and mercurial temperament which are the stock in trade of your adventurer in all ages. Meanwhile he tramped mechanically on through the night, until he felt that he could tramp no more. He had skirted the little township of Guichen, and now, within a half-mile of Guignen, and with Gavrillac a good 7 miles behind him, his legs refused to carry him any farther. He was midway across the vast common to the north of Guignen when he came to a halt. He had left the road and taken heedlessly to the footpath that struck across the waste of indifferent pasture interspersed with clumps of gorse. A stone's throw away on his right, the common was bordered by a thorn hedge. Beyond this loomed a tall building which he knew to be an open barn, standing on the edge of a long stretch of meadowland. That dark, silent shadow it may have been that brought him to a standstill, suggesting shelter to his subconsciousness. A moment he hesitated. Then he struck across towards a spot where a gap in the hedge was closed by a 5-barred gate. He pushed the gate open, went through the gap, and stood now before the barn. It was as big as a house. It consisted of no more than a roof carried upon half a dozen tall brick pillars. But densely packed under that roof was a great stack of hay that promised a warm couch on so cold a night. Stout timbers had been built into the brick pillars, with projecting ends to serve as ladders by which the laborer might climb to pack or withdraw hay. With what little strength remained him, André Louis climbed by one of these and landed safely at the top, where he was forced to kneel, for lack of room to stand upright. Arrived there, he removed his coat and neckcloth, his sodden boots and stockings. Next, he cleared a trough for his body, and lying down in it, covered himself to the neck with the hay he had removed. Within 5 minutes, he was lost to all worldly cares, and soundly asleep. When next he awakened, the sun was already high in the heavens, from which he concluded that the morning was well advanced. And this before he realized quite where he was or how he came there. Then to his awakening senses came a drone of voices close at hand, to which at first he paid little heed. He was deliciously refreshed, luxuriously drowsy, and luxuriously warm. But as consciousness and memory grew more full, he raised his head clear of the hay that he might free both ears to listen, his pulses faintly quickened by the nascent fear that those voices might bode him no good. Then he caught the reassuring accents of a woman, musical and silvery, though laden with alarm.
"Ah, mon Dieu, Leandre, let us separate at once, if it should be my father."
And upon this a man's voice broke in, calm and reassuring.
"No, no, Clemen, you are mistaken. There is no one coming. We are quite safe. Why do you start at shadows?"
"Ah, Leandre, if he should find us here together, I tremble at the very thought."
More was not needed to reassure André Louis. He had overheard enough to know that this was but the case of a pair of lovers, who, with less to fear of life, were yet, after the manner of their kind, more timid of heart than he. Curiosity drew him from his warm trough to the edge of the hay. Lying prone, he advanced his head and peered down. In the space of cropped meadow between the barn and the hedge stood a man and a woman, both young. The man was a well-set-up, comely fellow, with a fine head of chestnut hair tied in a queue by a broad bow of black satin. He was dressed with certain tawdry attempts at ostentatious embellishments, which did not prepossess one at first glance in his favor. His coat, of a fashionable cut, was of faded plum-colored velvet edged with silver lace, whose glory had long since departed. He affected ruffles, but for want of starch they hung like weeping willows over his hands that were fine and delicate. His breeches were of plain black cloth, and his black stockings were of cotton, matters entirely out of harmony with his magnificent coat. His shoes, stout and serviceable, were decked with buckles of cheap, lackluster paste. But for his engaging and ingenious countenance, André Louis must have set him down as a knight of that order which lives dishonestly by its wits. As it was, he suspended judgment whilst pushing investigation further by a study of the girl. At the outset, be it confessed that it was a study that attracted him prodigiously. And this notwithstanding the fact that, bookish and studious as were his ways, and in despite of his years, it was far from his habit to waste consideration on femininity. The child, she was no more than that, perhaps 20 at the most, possessed, in addition to the allurements of face and shape that went very near perfection, a sparkling vivacity, and a grace of movement the like of which André Louis did not remember ever before to have beheld assembled in one person. And her voice, too, that musical, silvery voice that had awakened him, possessed in its exquisite modulations an allurement of its own that must have been irresistible, he thought, in the ugliest of her sex. She wore a hooded mantle of green cloth, and the hood being thrown back, her dainty head was all revealed to him. There were glints of gold struck by the morning sun from her light, nut-brown hair that hung in a cluster of curls about her oval face. Her complexion was of a delicacy that he could compare only with a rose petal. He could not at that distance discern the color of her eyes, but he guessed them blue, as he admired the sparkle of them under the fine, dark line of eyebrows. He could not have told you why, but he was conscious that it aggrieved him to find her so intimate with this pretty young fellow, who was partly clad, as it appeared, in the cast-offs of a nobleman. He could not guess her station, but the speech that reached him was cultured in tone and word. He strained to listen.
"I shall know no peace, Leandre, until we are safely wed," she was saying. "Not until then shall I count myself beyond his reach. And yet if we marry without his consent, we but make trouble for ourselves, and of gaining his consent I almost despair."
Evidently, thought André Louis, her father was a man of sense, who saw through the shabby finery of Monsieur Leandre, and was not to be dazzled by cheap paste buckles.
"My dear Climene,"
the young man was answering her, standing squarely before her and holding both her hands,
"you are wrong to despond. If I do not reveal to you all the stratagem that I have prepared to win the consent of your unnatural parent, it is because I am loath to rob you of the pleasure of the surprise that is in store. But place your faith in me, and in that ingenious friend of whom I have spoken, and who should be here at any moment."
The stilted ass! Had he learnt that speech by heart in advance, or was he by nature a pedantic idiot who expressed himself in this set and formal manner? How came so sweet a blossom to waste her perfume on such a prig? And what a ridiculous name the creature owned! Thus André Louis to himself from his observatory. Meanwhile she was speaking.
"That is what my heart desires, Leandre. But I am beset by fears lest your stratagem should be too late. I am to marry this horrible Marquis of Sbrufadelli this very day. He arrives by noon. He comes to sign the contract, to make me Marchioness of Sbrufadelli. Oh!"
It was a cry of pain from that tender young heart.
"The very name burns my lips. If it were mine, I could never utter it. Never! The man is so detestable. Save me, Leandre, save me. You are my only hope."
André Louis was conscious of a pang of disappointment. She failed to soar to the heights he had expected of her. She was evidently infected by the stilted manner of her ridiculous lover. There was an atrocious lack of sincerity about her words. They touched his mind, but left his heart unmoved. Perhaps this was because of his antipathy to Monsieur Leandre and to the issue involved. So, her father was marrying her to a marquis. That implied birth on her side. And yet she was content to pair off with this dull young adventurer in the tarnished lace. It was, he supposed, the sort of thing to be expected of a sex that all philosophy had taught him to regard as the maddest part of a mad species.
"It shall never be," Monsieur Leandre was storming passionately. "Never! I swear it!"
And he shook his puny fist at the blue vault of heaven, Ajax defying Jupiter.
"Ah, but here comes our subtle friend."
André Louis did not catch the name, Monsieur Leandre having at that moment turned to face the gap in the hedge. "He will bring us news, I know." André Louis looked also in the direction of the gap. Through it emerged a lean, slight man in a rusty cloak and a three-cornered hat worn well down over his nose so as to shade his face. And when presently he doffed this hat and made a sweeping bow to the young lovers, André Louis confessed to himself that had he been cursed with such a hang-dog countenance, he would have worn his hat in precisely such a manner, so as to conceal as much of it as possible. If Monsieur Leandre appeared to be wearing, in part at least, the cast-offs of a nobleman, the newcomer appeared to be wearing the cast-offs of Monsieur Leandre. Yet, despite his vile clothes and viler face, with its 3 days' growth of beard, the fellow carried himself with a certain air. He positively strutted as he advanced, and he made a leg in a manner that was courtly and practiced.
"Monsieur," said he, with the air of a conspirator, "the time for action has arrived, and so has the Marquis. That is why."
The young lovers sprang apart in consternation, Climene with clasped hands, parted lips, and a bosom that raced distractingly under its white fichu menteur. Monsieur Leandre agape, the very picture of foolishness and dismay. Meanwhile the newcomer rattled on.
"I was at the inn an hour ago when he descended there, and I studied him attentively whilst he was at breakfast. Having done so, not a single doubt remains me of our success. As for what he looks like, I could entertain you at length upon the fashion in which nature has designed his gross fatuity, but that is no matter. We are concerned with what he is, and with the wit of him, and I tell you confidently that I find him so dull and stupid that you may be confident he will tumble headlong into each and all of the traps I have so cunningly prepared for him."
Tell me, speak,"
Climene implored him, holding out her hands in a supplication no man of sensibility could have resisted. And then, on the instant, she caught her breath on a faint scream.
"My father!"
she exclaimed, turning distractedly from one to the other of the two.
"He is coming! We are lost!"
"You must fly, Climene," said Monsieur Leandre.
"Too late!" she sobbed. "Too late! He is here!"
"Calm, mademoiselle, calm!" the subtle friend was urging her. "Keep calm and trust to me. I promise you that all shall be well."
"Oh," cried Monsieur Leandre limply, "say what you will, my friend, this is ruin, the end of all our hopes. Your wits will never extricate us from this. Never."
Through the gap strode now an enormous man with an inflamed moon face and a great nose, decently dressed after the fashion of a solid bourgeois. There was no mistaking his anger, but the expression that it found was an amazement to André Louis.
"Leandre, you're an imbecile! Too much phlegm! Too much phlegm! Your words wouldn't convince a ploughboy. Have you considered what they mean at all? Thus!" he cried, casting his round hat from him in a broad gesture.
He took his stand at Monsieur Leandre's side, and repeated the very words that Leandre had lately uttered, what time the three observed him coolly and attentively.
"Oh, say what you will, my friend. This is ruin, the end of all our hopes. Your wits will never extricate us from this, never!"
A frenzy of despair vibrated in his accents. He swung again to face Monsieur Leandre.
"Thus," he bade him contemptuously, "let the passion of your hopelessness express itself in your voice. Consider that you are not asking Scaramouche here whether he has put a patch in your breeches. You are a despairing lover, expressing..."
He checked abruptly, startled. André Louis, suddenly realizing what was afoot and how duped he had been, had loosed his laughter. the sound of it pealing and booming uncannily under the great roof that so immediately confined him was startling to those below. The fat man was the first to recover, and he announced it after his own fashion in one of the ready sarcasms in which he habitually dealt.
"Hark!" he cried. "The very gods laugh at you, Leandre."
Then he addressed the roof of the barn and its invisible tenant.
"Hi! You there!"
André Louis revealed himself by a further protrusion of his tousled head.
"Good morning," said he, pleasantly.
Rising now on his knees, his horizon was suddenly extended to include the broad common beyond the hedge. He beheld there an enormous and very battered travelling chaise, a cart piled up with timbers, partly visible under the sheet of oiled canvas that covered them, and a sort of house on wheels equipped with a tin chimney, from which the smoke was slowly curling. Three heavy Flemish horses and a couple of donkeys, all of them hobbled, were contentedly cropping the grass in the neighborhood of these vehicles. These, had he perceived them sooner, must have given him the clue to the queer scene that had been played under his eyes. Beyond the hedge other figures were moving. Three at that moment came crowding into the gap, a saucy-faced girl with a tip-tilted nose, whom he supposed to be Columbine, the soubrette, a lean, active youngster, who must be the lackey Harlequin, and another rather loutish youth, who might be a zany or an apothecary. All this he took in at a comprehensive glance that consumed no more time than it had taken him to say good morning. To that good morning Pantaloon replied in a bellow,
"What the devil are you doing up there?"
"Precisely the same thing that you are doing down there," was the answer. "I am trespassing."
"Eh?"
said Pantaloon, and looked at his companions, some of the assurance beaten out of his big red face, although the thing was one that they did habitually. To hear it called by its proper name was disconcerting.
"Whose land is this?"
he asked, with diminishing assurance. André Louis answered, whilst drawing on his stockings, "I believe it to be the property of the Marquis de la Tour d'Azyr."
"That's a high-sounding name. Is the gentleman severe?"
"The gentleman," said André Louis, "is the devil. Or rather, I should prefer to say upon reflection that the devil is a gentleman by comparison." "And yet," interposed the villainous-looking fellow who played Scaramouche, "by your own confessing you don't hesitate yourself to trespass upon his property." "Ah, but then you see, I am a lawyer, and lawyers are notoriously unable to observe the law, just as actors are notoriously unable to act. Moreover, sir, nature imposes her limits upon us, and nature conquers respect for laws as she conquers all else. Nature conquered me last night, when I had got as far as this, and so I slept here without regard for the very high and puissant Marquis de la Tour d'Azyr. At the same time, Monsieur Scaramouche, you'll observe that I did not flaunt my trespass quite as openly as you and your companions." Having donned his boots, André Louis came nimbly to the ground in his shirt-sleeves, his riding-coat over his arm. As he stood there to don it, the little cunning eyes of the heavy father conned him in detail, observing that his clothes, if plain, were of a good fashion, that his shirt was of a fine cambric, and that he expressed himself like a man of culture. Such as he claimed to be, Monsieur Pantaloon was disposed to be civil.
"I am very grateful to you for the warning, sir," he was beginning.
"Act upon it, my friend. The garde champêtre of Monsieur Désir have orders to fire on trespassers. Imitate me, and decamp." They followed him upon the instant through the gap in the hedge to the encampment on the common. There André Louis took his leave of them, but as he was turning away he perceived a young man of the company performing his morning toilet at a bucket placed upon one of the wooden steps at the tail of the house on wheels. A moment he hesitated. Then he turned frankly to Monsieur Pantaloon, who was still at his elbow. "If it were not unconscionable to encroach so far upon your hospitality, monsieur," said he, I would beg leave to imitate that very excellent young gentleman before I leave you.
But, my dear sir,
good nature oozed out of every pore of the fat body of the master player,
it is nothing at all. But, by all means, Rodomont will provide what you require. He is the dandy of the company in real life, though a fire-eater on the stage. Hi, Rodomont!
The young ablutionist straightened his long body from the right angle in which it had been bent over the bucket, and looked out through a foam of soap-suds. Pantaloon issued an order, and Rodomont, who was indeed as gentle and amiable off the stage as he was formidable and terrible upon it, made the stranger free of the bucket in the friendliest manner. So André Louis once more removed his neckcloth and his coat, and rolled up the sleeves of his fine shirt, whilst Rodomont procured him soap, a towel, and presently a broken comb and even a greasy hair ribbon, in case the gentleman should have lost his own. This last André Louis declined, but the comb he gratefully accepted, and having presently washed himself clean, stood with the towel flung over his left shoulder, restoring order to his dishevelled locks before a broken piece of mirror affixed to the door of the travelling house. He was standing thus, what time the gentle Rodomont babbled aimlessly at his side, when his ears caught the sound of hooves. He looked over his shoulder carelessly, and then stood frozen, with uplifted comb and loosened mouth. Away across the common, on the road that bordered it, he beheld a party of seven horsemen, in the blue coats with red facings, of the Merchausset. Not for a moment did he doubt what was the quarry of this prowling gendarmerie. It was as if the chill shadow of the gallows had fallen suddenly upon him. And then the troop halted, abreast with them, and the sergeant, leading it, sent his bawling voice across the common.
"Hi there! Hi!"
His tone rang with menace. Every member of the company, and there were some 12 in all, stood at gaze. Pantaloon advanced a step or two, stalking, his head thrown back, his manner that of a king's lieutenant.
"Now, what the devil's this?"
quoth he, but whether of fate or heaven or the sergeant was not clear. There was a brief colloquy among the horsemen. Then they came trotting across the common straight towards the players' encampment. André Louis had remained standing at the tail of the travelling house. He was still passing the comb through his straggling hair, but mechanically and unconsciously. His mind was all intent upon the advancing troop, his wits alert and gathered together for a leap in whatever direction should be indicated. Still in the distance, but evidently impatient, the sergeant bawled a question.
"Who gave you leave to encamp here?"
It was a question that reassured André Louis not at all. He was not deceived by it into supposing or even hoping that the business of these men was merely to round up vagrants and trespassers. That was no part of their real duty. It was something done in passing, done perhaps in the hope of levying a tax of their own. It was very long odds that they were from Rennes, and that their real business was the hunting down of a young lawyer charged with sedition. Meanwhile, Pantaloon was shouting back.
"Who gave us leave, do you say? What leave? This is communal land, free to all."
The sergeant laughed unpleasantly and came on, his troop following. "There is," said a voice at Pantaloon's elbow, "no such thing as communal land in the proper sense in all Monsieur de La Tour d'Azyr's vast domain. This is terre censive, and his bailiffs collect his dues from all who send their beasts to graze here." Pantaloon turned to behold at his side André Louis, in his shirt-sleeves, and without a neckcloth, the towel still trailing over his left shoulder, a comb in his hand, his hair half-dressed.
"God of God!" swore Pantaloon. "But it is an ogre, this Marquis de La Tour d'Azyr."
"I have told you already what I think of him," said André Louis. "As for these fellows, you had better let me deal with them. I have experience of their kind." And without waiting for Pantaloon's consent, André-Louis stepped forward to meet the advancing men of the Marechaussee. He had realized that here boldness alone could save him. When, a moment later, the sergeant pulled up his horse alongside of this half-dressed young man, André-Louis combed his hair, what time he looked up with a half-smile intended to be friendly, ingenious, and disarming. In spite of it, the sergeant hailed him gruffly.
"Are you the leader of this troop of vagabonds?"
"Yes. That is to say, my father there is really the leader," and he jerked a thumb in the direction of Monsieur Pantaloon, who stood at gaze out of earshot in the background. "What is your pleasure, Captain?"
"My pleasure is to tell you that you are very likely to be jailed for this, all the pack of you."
His voice was loud and bullying. It carried across the common to the ears of every member of the company, and brought them all to stricken attention where they stood. The lot of strolling players was hard enough, without the addition of jailings.
"But how so, my captain? This is communal land, free to all." "It is nothing of the kind."
"Where are the fences?" quoth André-Louis, waving the hand that held the comb as if to indicate the openness of the place.
"Fences!" snorted the sergeant. "What have fences to do with the matter? This is terre censive. There is no grazing here, save by payment of dues to the Marquis de la Tour d'Azyr."
"But we are not grazing," quoth the innocent André-Louis.
"To the devil with you, zany! You are not grazing, but your beasts are grazing."
"They eat so little," André-Louis apologized, and again essayed his ingratiating smile. The sergeant grew more terrible than ever.
"That is not the point. The point is that you are committing what amounts to a theft, and there's the jail for thieves."
"Technically, I suppose you are right," sighed André-Louis, and fell to combing his hair again, still looking up into the sergeant's face. "But we have sinned in ignorance. We are grateful to you for the warning." He passed the comb into his left hand, and with his right fumbled in his breeches pocket, whence there came a faint jingle of coins. "We are desolated to have brought you out of your way. Perhaps, for their trouble, your men would honor us by stopping at the next inn to drink the health of this Monsieur de la Tour d'Azyr, or any other health that they think proper." Some of the clouds lifted from the sergeant's brow, but not yet all.
"Well, well," said he gruffly, "but you must decamp, you understand."
He leaned from the saddle to bring his recipient hand to a convenient distance. André-Louis placed in it a 3 livres piece.
"In half an hour," said André-Louis. "Why in half an hour? Why not at once?"
"Oh, but time to break our fast." They looked at each other. The sergeant next considered the broad piece of silver in his palm. Then at last his features relaxed from their sternness.
"After all," said he, "it is none of our business to play the tipstaves for Monsieur de la Tour d'Azyr. We are of the Marechaussee from Rennes."
André-Louis' eyelids played him false by flickering.
"But if you linger, look out for the garde champêtre of the Marquis. You'll find them not at all accommodating." "Well, well, a good appetite to you, monsieur," said he in valediction.
"A pleasant ride, my captain," answered André-Louis. The sergeant wheeled his horse about. His troop wheeled with him. They were starting off when he reined up again.
"You! Monsieur!"
he called over his shoulder. In a bound, André-Louis was beside his stirrup.
"We are in quest of a scoundrel named André-Louis Moreau, from Gavrillac, a fugitive from justice wanted for the gallows on a matter of sedition. You've seen nothing, I suppose, of a man whose movements seemed to you suspicious?"
"Indeed we have," said André-Louis very boldly, his face eager with consciousness of the ability to oblige.
"You have?" cried the sergeant, in a ringing voice. "Where? When?"
yesterday evening in the neighborhood of Guinen.
Yes, yes.
The sergeant felt himself hot upon the trail.
There was a fellow who seemed very fearful of being recognized, a man of 50 or thereabouts.
50, cried the sergeant, and his face fell. Bah! This man of ours is no older than yourself. A thin wisp of a fellow of about your own height and of black hair, just like your own, by the description. Keep a lookout on your travels, Master Player. The King's Lieutenant in Rennes has sent us word this morning that he will pay 10 louis to anyone giving information that will lead to this scoundrel's arrest. So there's 10 louis to be earned by keeping your eyes open and sending word to the nearest justices. It would be a fine windfall for you, that.
A fine windfall indeed, Captain, answered Andre Louis, laughing. But the sergeant had touched his horse with the spur, and was already trotting off in the wake of his men. Andre Louis continued to laugh, quite silently, as he sometimes did when the humor of a jest was peculiarly keen. Then he turned slowly about, and came back towards Pantaloon and the rest of the company, who were now all grouped together at gaze. Pantaloon advanced to meet him with both hands outheld. For a moment Andre Louis thought he was about to be embraced.
"We hail you, our savior," the big man declaimed. "Already the shadow of the jail was creeping over us, chilling us to the very marrow. For though we be poor, yet are we all honest folk, and not one of us has ever suffered the indignity of prison, nor is there one of us who would survive it. But for you, my friend, it might have happened. What magic did you work?"
"The magic that is to be worked in France with a king's portrait. The French are a very loyal nation. As you will have observed, they love their king and his portrait even better than himself, especially when it is wrought in gold. But even in silver it is respected." The sergeant was so overcome by the sight of that noble visage, on a 3 livres piece, that his anger vanished, and he has gone his ways, leaving us to depart in peace.
"Ah, true. He said we must decamp. About it, my lads. Come, come."
"But not until after breakfast," said Andre Louis. A half hour for breakfast was conceded us by that loyal fellow, so deeply was he touched. True, he spoke of possible garde champêtre, but he knows as well as I do that they are not seriously to be feared, and that if they came, again the king's portrait, wrought in copper this time, would produce the same melting effect upon them. So, my dear Monsieur Pantaloon, break your fast at your ease. I can smell your cooking from here, and from the smell I argue that there is no need to wish you a good appetite.
"My friend, my savior!" Pantaloon flung a great arm about the young man's shoulders. "You shall stay to breakfast with us."
"I confess to a hope that you would ask me," said Andre Louis. End of Chapter 1, Book 2 of Scaramouche. As read by Gordon Mackenzie. December 2006. Troy, Michigan.